Hello, and welcome to another episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen. It's made in collaboration with the wonderful charity that is simply Help Musicians. I'll be in the company of a wonderful chap who's had a long and varied career. He was a pioneer in pub rock. He produced The Damned, Elvis Costello, Dr. Feelgood, and many more. He's been in a band with Ry Cooder and John Hyatt. I'm so jealous. He wrote a track that appeared in The Bodyguard. I'm so jealous. Which is an album that sold 44 million copies. That's a lot of fish and chips. And at one time, Johnny Cash was his father-in-law. Please welcome the beautiful, young Nick Lowe. Nick Lowe, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for Help Musicians. Are you aware of them as a charity?
I'm not. No, not until you told me about it.
Well, during the pandemic last year, the year before, they doled out £19.3 million to over 20,000 musicians.
Really?
Yeah. So I don't know if you want to sign up.
Holy smoke.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That sounds fantastic. Where did this dough come from?
Beneficiaries, I'm not quite sure who, but it was started over 100 years ago by Vaughan Williams, and it's been going ever since.
Well, first class. Thank you very much for asking me to be involved with it in whatever way you wish me to be involved in it.
Do you think back in the day, like in the early 70s, a charity like Help Musicians would have been really useful for the struggling artists like you and me?
Well, I think there's a difference between you and me and Vaughan Williams' violinist. You know, I used to sort of revel in my poverty back in those days. I never really felt that poor, actually. I didn't have a bean, really. But I seemed to have plenty of cigarettes, I remember that, and could, you know, get a pint in the pub. But I don't think I ate very much.
No.
And lived in quite, really terrible, reduced circumstances. But I never seemed to kind of mind. Living seemed to be a lot easier back then. Or maybe it was just because we were young. I don't know. Were you ever in reduced circumstances, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I lived on a council estate and my mum and dad didn't have a lot of money at all. And so when I started a band, it was a struggle to pay for rehearsals. Was it the same sort of thing for you?
I didn't. It was Brinsley, really, who took care of all that. Right. You know, he ran the band, really. I was, you know, I was too creative to be troubled with things as mundane as rehearsal costs.
So would he just say, well, OK, we're rehearsing this week, can you be there?
Yes. And mind you, I was actually sleeping on his parents' floor at the time, so I was very available.
Why was this? Had you left home or had you been thrown out?
No, I'd left home to join the group. I'd been at school with Brinsley. When I left, I had a couple of jobs, you know, sort of menial jobs. I didn't have any success at school, really.
No.
Even though I went to quite a posh school and actually picked up quite a good education, but I didn't get any exams. I seemed to have an inability to pass any exams. And I was so keen on, I wouldn't say being a musician, because actually the artistic side of it didn't come into it. I really just wanted to be on the telly.
Did you?
And be famous, yeah. Which I seem to spend all my time trying to avoid nowadays.
That's a great ambition to have as a young boy. I remember having that ambition of watching Top of the Pops and thinking, I want to do that.
Yes, quite. Yeah. Yeah, that was really what I wanted to do. And I had a few jobs, but then Brinsley called up one day and said, we've fallen out with the bass player. Do you want to join the group? And they'd had a record. They were signed to Parlophone, which was a big deal then, because that was the Beatles' label, you know. And I thought that if you signed to Parlophone, you were, you know, round at the Beatles, at Paul McCartney's house, having tea, you know, the next day. You're all in some big club.
Yeah.
Little did I know that, you know, we were one of thousands of groups that they'd signed up, and we got sort of a fraction of a farthing per record sale, you know, for singles that we sold. Also, I found out that they didn't play on their records, which was really commonplace at that time, but it was news to me.
Yeah.
And I did think, when I heard Brinsley's group's records on the radio at that time, I thought, man, this sounds pretty good. But there was a reason for that.
Yeah.
It's because of Big Jim Sullivan and, you know, John Paul Jones and whoever the hotshot session guys were all playing on the Kivington Lodge's record.
And were your parents supportive of you playing the bass in Brinsley's band?
Well, if they weren't, they did a very good impersonation of it. I think they would probably realise that, you know, they couldn't really say no, you know, apart from the fact that I was 18 by that time.
Mm.
And I showed every indication, you know, that I was headed for total failure, you know, unless I gave this a crack. And at that time as well, you know, in the late 60s, there wasn't any unemployment.
Mm.
You could do something like that and it wouldn't be a major disaster. There was there always seemed to be opportunities to grasp.
Did your mum and dad listen to records?
Oh, yeah, yes. My mother especially was very musical. In fact, she taught me how to, you know, play the guitar, rudimentary chords on the guitar. She knew how to do that. And she was a really pretty good singer too. And she had a very good record collection in retrospect. The sort of things that you'd find in a sort of middle-class household at that time. A lot of soundtracks of shows, you know, like Oklahoma and
yeah.
South Pacific,
yes.
My Fair Lady and that sort of thing. But a lot of good singers too. Nat King Cole and Sinatra, of course. But also Peggy Lee and Dinah Washington, Doris Day, who I think are all great now. I think all that stuff is great now. Some jazz as well, Sidney Bechet and Kenny Clarke. My dad has this jazz stuff. But also she had these two, rather incongruously, she had these two 10-inch albums by Tennessee Ernie Ford. Mm-hmm. I don't know where she got them from, or how they came into her possession, but Tennessee Ernie Ford is known primarily for a massive hit song, 16 Tons, a little gem of a record. It was so brilliantly arranged, an incredibly clever song. And it was a huge hit, quite rightly. But anyway, I totally fell in love with these two records and played them incessantly. Oh, I played them all the records they had incessantly. But I loved these two in particular. And didn't just like Tennessee Ernie. I liked these people he was playing with because they sounded so cool as well. I didn't really know that it was...
Mm.
It didn't sound like the country and western, as far as I understood it to be, because it had this jazz feel to it as well. I know now that it was sort of West Coast, California country and western, which had this jazz feel to it, which came from the war. You know, so many folks graduated from the South up to California to the shipyards and build planes at Boeing and that sort of thing, and they brought with them this Bob Wills sort of style. You know, there's a lot of jazz mixed in with his country songs, you know, simple campfire kind of country songs, but with this jazz influence, and I totally fell for it.
Did it make you think, well, maybe I could write a song?
I thought that was pretty beyond me, really. It wasn't until I heard the first sort of rock and roll stuff, the really simple rock and roll stuff, like Good Golly Miss Molly or Buddy Holly's things, that it was so much more basic and simple than not only Tennessee Ernie Ford, but, you know, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair, or have you heard It's in the Stars, Next July We Collide with Mars, whatever
Mars.
This swell party this is, you know, which sounded to me like aliens had written that, you know, that was way beyond me. But when I heard sort of Rave On or something by Buddy Holly, I thought, well, Rave On, this crazy feeling, well, I know it's got... I thought, man, I could do that, you know, but but of course I couldn't.
But you did.
Well, later on, but it took quite a long time.
To percolate.
Yeah, I came up with a song when I was about 13 or 14 about the great train robbery. That was the first thing I did. I was going through an infatuation with the Kingston Trio, who were these very clean-cut American sort of folkies. Pop folk, really, is what they did. And I went through a little infatuation with them. So I wrote this Kingston Trio-influenced song about the great train robbery. I think that was the first effort I made. And then my sister used to get these teen... I had an older sister, I still have an older sister, but she used to get these teen papers, you know, for girls, and they'd have a sort of love poem. And one of the features was a kind of love poem. And I got one of these love poems and thought up a few chords and came up with something there. But it took me quite a long time to actually knock one out that was... sounded like a song.
So what was the, if you could paint a picture of your bedroom in those days, did you idolise anybody, have posters on the wall or a train set or anything like that?
Well, that's, I don't think I did really, because, well, for two reasons. One was that we all seemed to be on the move all the time. My dad was in the Air Force.
I see.
That's why I support Brentford now, because I've lived here for 40 years, you know, but I never had a football team, you know, so I never really came from anywhere. So we were always on the move. And then I went to boarding school, you know, so I suppose my room was fairly austere, really.
So it was pretty good training for being in a rock and roll band then,
yeah,
living around all the time.
I was going to say that, it was.
What was it like in Brinsley's band then at the beginning? Was it a democratic setup where you could walk in with a song one day and say, should we have a go?
Yeah, it was actually. I think that, well, I don't want to speak for the others, but I realised pretty early on that it was essential that you had to write your own songs if you wanted to have any kind of career. Mm. We weren't very attractive bunch as well, you know, so I mean, anyone who had a guitar around their neck in those days would have attract certain number of very young, spotty girls who would sort of squeal at you. And we were very much on that scene. Mm. But we wanted to get in the college, so what they used to call the college scene, where the girls were all much prettier and more sort of intelligent as we saw it. Not that we were, but we fancied ourselves as being a bit more arty-farty, you know. So we wanted to get in on the college scene instead of the scene we were on, which was Hastings Pier, I seem to remember, we used to play on quite a lot. And so writing songs was something you had to really get down to and get cracking. Our first efforts were... Well, Brinsley had written quite a few before I joined. He'd written a few songs, quite poppy and melodic and sort of cute, you know. Mm. Because I'd been a mod before I joined the band, and I really thought, because I'd heard a couple of R&B records, and I really thought that I knew exactly what was going on and how we should conduct ourselves, you know. And so the first thing is I came in and I said, right, boys, I'll tell you what, we play on our own records now. Okay, now I've got to put a foot down here. No more session, guys. And well, of course, that was a terrible mistake because, you know, they immediately sounded much, much worse than the records that we mysteriously, the group had made before I joined. And I remember on one occasion, on one of the records we made, oh, God, I can't remember what it was. We had some sort of crackpot notion. Oh, they wanted to, that's right. We wanted to put one of our songs on the A side or something. Well, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a deal we made with our management that we had to record a song by the guitar player from Herman's Hermits. You know, someone in the office managed Herman's Hermit. Yeah. So anyway, we thought this was a terrible idea. But nonetheless, in order for us to get our way with whatever it was we wanted to get our way with, this poor chap came down to Abbey Road, it was. We used to record at Abbey Road. And this chap turned up with his guitar to show us this song. Well, we behaved so badly towards this poor chap. He was ever such a nice guy, he was. I can't remember what his name was now, but we behaved terribly badly to him, you know, sniggering and sort of, and he's trying to show us the song, exaggerated yawnings and looking at our watches and things like that, and sort of monosyllabic you know. Oh, it was awful. You know, and even when I think about it now, you know,
it sounds great.
I'm ashamed, really. Anyway, we did it. You know, we did the song. I'm just rambling now, actually. I'm sort of back there again now. But anyway, ask me something else.
It reminded me of when you did Top of the Pops back in the day. You used to have to go in and pretend to re-record your track, and there'd be somebody from the Musicians Union there, and your manager would take them to the pub mysteriously for 2 hours, by which time you'd all sit around smoking and having a sandwich. And by the time they'd come back, you just gave them the original tape and they didn't even know. Do you remember that?
Yes, the arm round the shoulder.
Yes.
Yeah, the boys are going to be tuning up the snare drum for a while. Sure, let's just go out and fancy a sandwich. Yeah, there's a pub next door. I think you can probably get a sandwich in there. Yeah, and they come back an hour or two later, absolutely sloshed, and we give them the tape, yeah. The tape of the actual record, yeah.
Yeah, I remember being in the studio with Elvis Costello, and the BBC guy came down, the Musicians Union guy. And when they'd gone to the pub, we found in the stockroom, Is She Really Going Out With Him by Joe Jackson. So we took it and put it on the 2-inch tape machine, and Elvis sang over it.
Oh, really?
And gave it to him. He didn't know the difference. It was really strange.
Those are the days, a kinder, gentler time.
Yeah. There was a time when Brinsley's, I think, there's a story that I don't know if I've got this right, where you flew a load of journalists to Madison Square Garden. Is that correct?
Not quite, no. It's quite a long story, which I could try and truncate for you. At about the time that Kippington Lodge was trying to get off at this circuit I was telling you about, you know, reinvent ourselves as something a little more considered, you know, not as poppy. We looked for a new management, and we put an ad in the... No, we answered an ad in the Melody Maker for a management company looking for groups. And it was answered by Dave Robinson.
Wow.
Who went on to start Stiff Records. And he'd just come back from touring sort of relentlessly with Jimi Hendrix. He managed a group called Heir Apparent, they were called, opening for Jimi Hendrix on about 3 tours in a row, I think, in the days when tours used to last for months in the United States. That was all over, and he'd come back, and the Heir Apparent had broken up, and he decided to try and manage the group. Anyway, he came down and saw us, and he must have seen something in our act, even though it was our hometown. And I remember we did this gig, and there were probably about 5 people that turned up. But anyway, he saw something in us and decided to sign us up. And he got in with some other people, and this is all this whole story is compellingly told in Will Birch's book, No Sleep Till Canvey. But anyway, these people decided that in order to launch us, they had to do something pretty spectacular. And they came up with this idea of getting us a gig actually at the Fillmore East, which at that time was a place in New York, which was the sort of temple of sort of hippie music, I suppose, which we wanted to get in on. And they managed to get us a gig there at this place, opening for Quicksilver Messenger Service were the top group.
Oh, God,
shows you how long ago it was. And the middle group was Van Morrison, who just released his Moondance album.
Yeah.
And us. And they decided to charter a plane from Aer Lingus and fill it full of journalists. And it didn't matter if they were music journalists or not. Anyone who had access to the printed page was invited to be on this flight. And it was for a weekend in New York, really. Who wouldn't have gone on that?
Yeah.
And so they had people from, of course, the music press,
Fisherman's
but also
news.
Trout Fisherman, you know, Garden Ornament magazine, absolutely everybody. And there was very much, again, back in those days, there was a sort of a straight world and a sort of hippie world, which didn't blend. Nowadays, you know, kind of everybody's hip. Even the stupid people, you know, everyone's hip now. And so they got this plan on the road, got us the gig, got all the journalists lined up. From then on, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. Oh, God, it's so complicated, Chris. Are you sure you really want me to go into detail?
No, I know that it was complicated, and it was a PR disaster in some ways.
It was a disaster. We couldn't get visas to get into the journalists' plane. Started losing fuel or losing brake fluid or something. Had to keep on going back to either Heathrow or back to Shannon, where they used to stop in those days, because it was pre-jumbo jet days. Yeah. It was the 707. We used to just about gasp its way over from London to New York. So by the time they got to New York, it was like they'd been travelling for, you know, 3 or 4 days. So they were in no shape to go straight from the airport, pretty much, to see us play. And also, we couldn't get visas to get in. So we arrived at the Fillmore sort of half an hour before we were due to start playing as well. And we'd ordered up all this equipment. They'd asked us what equipment we needed. And, of course, what we did was order up all this, our dream gear.
Of course.
Which we had no idea how to play through or make a sound out of, you know. So we turned up with all these strange amps. So it was awful.
Yeah, well, I've had a similar experience when the height of Squeeze career. We flew on Concorde to New York with a journalist from the Sunday Mail, and we'd alerted a radio station in New York to gather up as many of our fans at JFK to meet us on the tarmac. And British Airways were really keen on this, and they printed up a load of cassettes in those days to give to the fans who were listening to the radio station as a gift. So we arrive in New York. You know, we think we're the Beatles. We walk down the steps and there's 10 people to greet us.
Yes,
it was disaster.
Yes, not quite what you had in mind.
Not quite what we had in mind at all. No, and then we went straight to a gig and did the same sort of thing. In the Brinsley Schwartz days, before we move on, you did a lot of festivals. Do you remember what they were like?
Yes, they were quite... we actually did the first Glastonbury.
Yeah,
the first and second one, yeah. In fact, until fairly recently, I think I had the record for playing, well, being paid to play Glastonbury more times than anyone else. It might have been broken by now, but until quite recently. But it had nothing to do with, you know, the public refusing to go to Glastonbury unless I was on the bill. It's because my agent was very good friends with Mike Leavis. But anyway, so we used to do quite a lot of festivals. I remember doing one, well, a few in Germany.
Of course.
It always seemed to be with the Edgar Broughton band.
Of course. I thought the first one was with David Bowie or Hawkwind and...
Oh, you mean Glastonbury?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think it was. Terry Reid, was he on as well? It was called the Worthy Farm Festival, I think. It wasn't called Glastonbury then. It was called the Worthy Farm Festival.
That's right.
And then the second one was called Glastonbury. The first one was... It was just a date, you know, on our way to Loughborough University.
Yeah. I heard a story also that Mark Bolan did that first one, and he had covered his Mini in velvet. He'd had it wallpapered in velvet. And when they were going down into the farm, of course, all the bushes tore the velvet off the side of his car, ruining his hippie image.
Yeah.
So moving from there, what happened after Brinsley?
Well... I suppose it was the pub rock thing was the...
Took off, didn't it?
It did take off. And in the perverse way, because when we came back from New York, to say we were the laughing stock, you know, of the British music business was an absolute understatement. Because the thing had been such a failure. It seemed so grandiose. I mean, in the ensuing years, you know, that sort of thing was commonplace, flying journalists so all over the world, you know, for a good write-up, you know, it was understood. But this was the first major thing, you know, that got publicity for it. And it was such a flop that for a while it was almost gangs of small boys following us down the street throwing stones at us, you know. But the weird thing was that we didn't, instead of breaking up, which we should have done, I suppose... We didn't have any choice, really. We didn't know anybody else, you know. And so we rented a large house in the suburbs of London. And and sort of hunkered down in this place and to sort of kind of lick our wounds. It was so traumatic, you know. But it had a rehearsal room there, and we started, or we just practiced and practiced and practiced. And we started to actually get pretty good. And also, it was like being in college or some sort of university, because we all would listen to the same records, and we get these sort of crazes for different types of music and things. And then we ran into this American band who were playing in this pub, and American band called Eggs Over Easy, and they were just like we wanted to be. You know, they played this great mix of cover songs and their own tunes, you know, and the covers seemed to be just like their own tunes. There was something very appealing about that. And when they went back to the States, we took over their spot in this pub that where they had quite a good following up in North London, the Tally Ho, it was called. And their act, really, we nicked as well. And in that perverse way that the Brits have, the fact that we've been the laughing stock, and now here we were playing in this big gin palace in North London with this pretty good little collection of original songs and cool covers and things, suddenly we were seen as being quite cool. You know, it sort of turns round, that your uncoolness suddenly becomes an asset. And people started turning out to see us.
I remember it well, because my very first band supported you and Ducks Deluxe in a pub in Abbey Wood in South London. And I always remember to this day, you were very generous. You gave me a cigarette.
Oh, that was nice of me.
It was nice of you. And you broke into conversation. And, you know, you remember those things when you're young and you're trying to get off the ground as a band.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you to remind everybody of it.
And you were great, you know, and Ducks Deluxe were a fine act. And I think the Flaming Groovies were also
around that same time. Right. Yeah, that does ring a bell. But anyway, as a result of that, the burgeoning pub rock scene, eventually we thought we'd done it enough, really. And it had been really good for our group. But I was hanging around with Jake Riviera by this time, who managed another pub rock group called the Chilly Willy.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd started spending more and more time round at his flat. He and I both could feel that this pub rock thing, which was essentially, if you remember, essentially a London thing. They tried to get it going everywhere at other parts of the country, and it didn't really work.
No.
The only other place where it seemed to work great was Holland. We used to go over to Holland all the time. They loved this bar band stuff over there. But we could definitely feel, and of course the Feel Goods had come along by this time, and they sort of changed it radically. You know, as you all know, people think that the blues is really easy to play, you know. And the Feel Goods were a blues band, but they were something else in spades, you know, in abundance, you know, more than just being a blues band. There's few things worse than a bad blues band.
Yeah, of course.
They spawned all these imitators, you know, and so it was suddenly horrible.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, we could feel that there was something just round the corner. We didn't know what it was, but it was always coming over the hill, was this thing, which we now know was the punk rock thing, which seemed to come really directly out of the pub rock scene.
It did, yeah. So did you used to go to pubs with Jake to sort of listen to bands? What sort of bands would you be watching?
Let me see. Yeah, I suppose we did. Yes, I suppose we did. Who did I like? I used to like... I love Kilburn and the High Roads. I loved them. I thought they were terrific.
Yeah. In each and every episode, we get to hear the personal story of a musician who has been supported by the wonderful people that help musicians. And right now, I'd like you to meet Allegra. So, Allegra, this is for help musicians, of course, and one of the first things I'd like to ask you is, when did you get the bug for writing?
I think when I was 9. I had piano lessons when I was 7, and then I just started playing around and making songs, but I think I started writing when I was about 11. So that was the first time I did lyrics, and I wrote because I was very introverted and had a lot of feelings. And then when I was about 12... just before my 13th birthday, I think my mum bought me a trip to the studio to record some of the songs that I was writing. And that was amazing. But I got to record 4 songs, and I wouldn't have shared those with anyone, but my mum did. Because she was kind of, she's always kind of been like that. She's very proud. So she shared my music. She put it up on a website and piqued the interest of a couple of managers. Mm-hmm. When I was 15 as well, I started a work experience when I was at school. And my mum got in touch with somebody who was a mutual friend through Judah. And he was actually a producer. And he said, yeah, sure, she can come and hang out for 2 weeks and make us coffees and stuff like that. And that's what I thought I would be doing. And one day these writers didn't turn up, and they had a free session, and they said, do you want to make some music? And I said, okay, yeah, sure. So then we started creating. I left school at that time, and I would just go to the studio regularly and record and record and record. And it was really good fun. I've only released 2 singles so far. I know it's not a lot, but it's a process of building. And in that time, I was able to get 2 grants, and one was from the Help Musicians that helped me do my music video for my 2nd single. And the 2nd grant was to produce and create my EP. And so that's what I've been working on this year and the last year.
That's fantastic. And what was it like when you went to Help Musicians for the first time?
It was really welcoming and helpful, and it was really perfect timing, because I decided about a year before that I was going to be a fully independent artist, at least for the time being. You know, I'd be an independent artist, and I left all my old London ties, and I had to rebuild from scratch when I moved across the country, and really was ground zero. I had to figure out, how do you even make a mastered track? I've never even done that. I've sat in studios and I've written so much, but I've never made a master track from beginning to end. So I had to figure that out. And Help Musicians came into my life. It was the perfect time to, you know, branch out and try something new. So yeah, I found the process really, really very warm, very caring, very nice. Yeah, it was really helpful.
Yeah, have you tried co-writing?
I've done it, yeah. I've had a lot of co-write sessions in the past, but I also found I'm really happy to be writing alone again.
Okay.
When I wrote music, as much as it was for me, it suddenly became, I have to fit it into how these people think I should write and what these people think a song should do at this point or this minute. You start editing yourself and you start flowing.
Yeah. Sometimes when you're co-writing, you can't share those personal feelings because it's only you that owns them.
Exactly. I think that's so true. And I think if I were to even sit down at this point now where I am with music and relate to my co-writer about what I want the song to be about, I wouldn't even be able to do that.
No.
Because the actual music is flowing out of me in real time. I have no idea where it's going.
Okay.
I sit down with a feeling and I just let it flow out.
Where is it you live?
I live just south of Blackpool.
South of Blackpool?
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's lovely. I'm by the beach.
But if I happen to be playing up there, well, you might come along and you can come and play some songs.
Oh, that would be lovely. Oh, thank you.
That'd be really good. Allegra, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Is there anything else that I can say about Help Musicians?
You said it beautifully. You can discover how to support Help Musicians, and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. So when did you first sort of strum up with Elvis? Because he was very much born out of the pub rock scene.
He was. Well, he was a big fan of the Brinsleys, Elvis.
He was indeed, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We used to see him all the time, especially when we were playing up in the sort of Northwest, you know, Liverpool and Manchester. He would come along. And then one day we were playing at the Cavern in Liverpool. It wasn't where the Beatles played, it was next door, you know, when Liverpool Council, I think, decided to knock the Cavern down. You know, probably a bad idea, really. But anyway, we were playing in the place next door. But we were in the pub that across the road, the Grapes, and Elvis came into the pub and we all noticed him, you know. He was, you know, quite unusual looking at that time, and he was on his own. He was always on his own. I think that I introduced myself to him. He says that he introduced himself to me. But anyway, that's when we first met in the Grapes over the road from the cavern. I was aware that he had a pub rock group going, but this was right sort of when I'd lost interest in it, really, in that scene. So I never saw his group. The next thing I knew was the day I ran into him after Stiff Records started, which Jake Riviera and, well, Jake started Stiff, and I became the sort of house producer for no other reason other than I had spent more time in the recording studio than anybody else involved in the thing. So I was sort of voted in into that job. But I ran into Elvis on the Royal Oak Tube Station, and he'd just been up there actually to buy a copy of So It Goes, which was the first Stiff record, which is a tune of mine, a record I made. So he started telling me that he was trying to get a break, you know, but he told me he was frightening people off. He'd get an interview with A&R people at record companies, and he'd take his guitar around. In fact, they didn't want a musician to come and actually sit and play their songs to him. They wanted a tape, you know, which they could sort of throw away or put in a file in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah.
So he said he wasn't getting anywhere with this. He said, I can see I make them very uncomfortable. He said, oh, no kidding. But anyway, and after I said goodbye to him, I went to Stiff myself, and they were listening to the tape he had actually dropped off.
Right.
Jake Riviera said, oh, this guy's really great. And initially, they were going to sign him as a writer. I don't know how that would have worked, but that seemed like a plan at that time. The more they listened to this tape, the more they thought, well, wait a minute, no, this is something else. And I was wheeled in to do some demos with him. And I didn't have much. What have I done? Oh, I'd produced Graham Parker's first album. That was my claim to fame at that time, and that was about it, I think. But anyway, as I say, Elvis had been keen on the Brinsleys, so he accepted the fact that that I would be the producer, and also I played bass on these demos as well.
Yeah. Around that time, we went to America for, I think it was our second tour, maybe our first tour, and Labour had Lust had just come out on a cassette, and I took it with me and played it to death. And I was always inspired by your lyrical take on things. Did the lyrics just come to you, or did you slave over them in those days?
I really should have slaved over them a little bit more. It seemed that good ideas were so for a penny. If you've got an idea, you say, well, that'll do, you know, we'll just go and knock that out, do a couple more verses, and there we are. And in fact, I wish now, in hindsight, that we'd taken a little more care, but it seemed that with this sort of the punk rock sort of vibe of, you know, it's fine, you know, no one really listens to this stuff much anyway, you know, that's okay, but it's not really. It's an excuse to not have to actually work at it, you know. It takes a lot of work to make it something sound like you've just made it up like that.
I know, but your lyrics to me at that point, and I was very into lyrics, of course, were very welcoming, and like, you painted a picture that was very easy to access, whereas with Elvis, I mean, he was just like a dictionary that just wouldn't stop singing. And there was a beauty to that, but there was a really inviting warmth to the songs that you were writing.
Oh, well, that's a great compliment coming from you. I take much more care of it now, really. You know, because when I listen on the occasions when I hear, I don't listen to my old records really at all, but occasionally I'll hear one, you know, on the radio or somewhere, I'll bump into one. And I very often think, oh, that's a really good idea. You know, why did you do that bit there? You know, you shouldn't have done that. And, oh, my God, you especially shouldn't have done it again near the end, you know.
But your lyrics these days on your last two or three albums have been so beautifully honest. And you can hear the honesty in your vocal. It's so beautiful. I remember asking you about writing songs, and you said you took a long time to get to the finishing line. Is that still the case?
Well, it is, really, yes. I don't think I ever really was particularly prolific. Perhaps in the days we've just been talking about, when you just knock stuff out, you know. But I'm much more fussy now and critical. Mm. I give up on things really, really easily and think, oh, I've heard all that, you know. Not still on about that, are you?
I think as you get older, the subject matter has to change too, and that's where the honesty comes in.
Yes, you do. I'm one of those people who I prefer to write a character, even though I say it'll be in the first person, I did this, I did that. Mm. It'll be in the voice of a character rather than a sort of a diary entry, you know.
Yes.
I've experienced, especially after, you know, however old, nearly 73, you know, I know what it feels like to have your heart broken, you know, and to have lied to people, you know, or to have been lied to, behaved badly and been misunderstood, or all those things, just like everybody has. I've suffered tragedy, you know, or great happiness. So I know what I'm talking about when my character describes something that's happened to them. It's not necessarily a true story, but you have to sort of give it the ring of truth, unless, of course, you're just trying to actually write some silly nonsense, you know. And
so they're like mini plays for today.
Well, that's nice work if you can get it, yeah. But yes, I do like that. And also I love this sort of the character of the hapless, somebody trying to do their best, you know, but just failing. You know, there's something endlessly fascinating about that, trying to do the right thing but just not being able to do it. I love that character, and I find it an endless source of material.
Is there a special place that you have to have when you write? Is there a comfy seat that you always sit in, or a room that you prefer?
Well, no, I can do it on the move, really. I'm a car guy, you know. I did try to do that. You know John Hiatt, I suppose?
Yeah.
I remember John telling me that he'd rented a room, like an office in Nashville, and he'd go in every day. He'd have a guitar and a piano, a couple of amps in there, you know, and a desk. And he said, oh, if I haven't written, you know, at least two songs a day, you know, I'm very disappointed in myself. Bloody hell, really? So I thought I'd better have a go at that. It wasn't exactly like I didn't get an office, but I started going to a venue, you know, every day and seeing what came out. And it did actually work for me. I did. Sometimes I'd go there with a real heavy heart, you know, thing. I'm just not in the mood today for this, you know, loading stuff in the back of the car and driving off.
Mm.
But once I got myself set up and everything, I always got something, you know, so I could see what he meant, but it didn't last long. It never caught fire quite for me.
And was that with the band in tow?
No, that was always on my own. I found that it was Elvis, actually, who encouraged me to do solo shows. He very kindly took me on this big world tour he went on. He went to Japan and Australia and America, and he hired me really just to play a bit of rhythm guitar in his band. He had this really top flight band with Jim Keltner and James Burton and all these real hot shots, you know. He hired me just to play a bit of rhythm guitar and do some backup harmonies, you know. It was a very nice job indeed. One day he said, why don't you go on before the show and do a few tunes, you know, on your own? You know, I said, whoa, no, I can't do that. And he'd recently started doing it. He said, oh, you'll really like it, you know, you'll really.
Yeah.
You know. And I did. I went on one night. He sort of made me, really. And I went on, and it sounded terrible to me, but the crowd seemed to love it. Maybe I should have a look at this, you know. And anyway, cut a long story short, I started to get into it. And the one thing I found was that when I started to do the records that we've just been talking about, my early records, I found that if you've just got an acoustic guitar, it really sort of showed this stuff up, you know. And I realized that the records I'd made where it was really just a half-assed idea, where I'd gone into the studio and thought, well, let's see if we can make something of this. It just didn't work, really. No. It was much better to have something that really stands up with just an acoustic. There's no fat on it, you know. Everything works. And suddenly I found that really improving my songwriting.
Absolutely. I remember seeing you with in the band Little Village. What was that like? Was that scary?
I suppose it was, yeah, to start with, yes. Yes, it was to start with.
To be on stage with Jim Keltner and Ryan Cooder, I mean, that's quite a tall order, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Yes, I can't say anything else than that, except that when suddenly I found that they liked my sort of very, very rudimentary bass playing, you know. It couldn't be too rudimentary for Rye, you know. The more sort of moronic, the more moronic, you know, and the less I actually changed chord, you know, changed note, the more he liked it. You know, I thought, oh, blimey, because I like this too, you know. And the more I realised that, the more comfortable I felt. Mm. The first thing we did was a John Hiatt record, you know, this Bring the Family, and that we had four days to do that, and it was really, really cracking. Then they got us to do a record in our own right, and that really wasn't a success. But I've got bootlegs that we did to promote these records of the four of us. I've got bootlegs, which are way better than the record we did. You know, by the time it started getting a bit greasier and looser and these strict arrangements started dropping away, you know, the music, it was fantastic. And I'm still very in touch with Rye, you know.
Oh, good.
We became really pretty good pals.
I like his last album.
Me too. I love the records he makes nowadays. Yeah, fantastic.
Wasn't that produced by his son?
Well, it's Joachim and the sound engineer and Rye. Yeah, they do it together because Joachim's great as well. He plays drums with Rye. He's fantastic too.
Speaking of sons, I remember in lockdown being very, very happy to see you playing in your living room with young Roy on the drums. And it was just like, yeah, there's still joy in the world, you know, it's still happiness.
Yeah, he's definitely got the feeling, you know, of being a musician, and which I find, you know, I've got mixed feelings about. You know, I prefer him to show an interest in plumbing or something, you know, that he could make some serious money at. But he's definitely has got a musician's temperament, and he's really pretty good, you know. But he's 16, you know, he needs some experience.
The music industry is completely different from when we first began, and I wouldn't really want to enter into it now, I don't think. It just seems like there's not enough stages in pubs to play on, and there's just not enough good songs. Seems weird to me.
Yes, I know what you mean. Yes, he's not really interested in being in a band, you know, which I was. I could think of a few things cooler than being in a band, you know, when I started. But him and his generation, they think it's a bit, you know, why would you want to do that? Although, you know, if some young band were going off on a nice little tour of Scandinavia or something and their drummer got ill and they asked him to go up for a couple of weeks, you know, I think he'd really enjoy that sort of thing. But starting out and getting the tunes together and up and down the motorway, all that sort of thing that we used to kind of really enjoy, that's of no interest to him. It's all, he likes doing stuff on his computer and things. But he's got this wide knowledge of music, which I didn't have at all. You know, my generation was so closed-minded to any other kind of thing that wasn't rock and roll or, you know, young people's music. Roy and his mates, they don't see any sort of difference, really, between, you know, if something's good, it's good. They don't have that sort of snobbery that my generation had. I was in my 40s before I thought, well, it's okay to say that I like Doris Day, you know, that sort of thing.
I saw Paul Carrack play recently, and his son plays drums too. And
yeah, he's a really good drummer, isn't he?
It's a really good show, you know, and it's lovely to hear Paul still out there on the stage.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we're big fans of his around here.
Yeah. So, Nick, what does songwriting look like for you now? You know, there's lots of songwriters out there who are finding it tough, they're on the ropes, they're thinking of doing other jobs like driving Amazon vans or whatever. It's really very, very sad, and I've been meeting some of them on Zoom. At your end of the corridor, if you like, is there anything you can say to them to pull them forward?
Well,
it's a difficult question, I grant you.
It is a difficult question because you know, fashions come and go. And I'm trying to get through this, figure out what you just said, you know, about lack of melodies. And most pop music nowadays is drum-led. That's the most important thing. I can think of so many things about this, but I don't quite know where to...
I know, it's just a different time and a different horizon for younger people, I think.
It's how to get it out there, you know. How to be original, you know. The problem is, again, something you said earlier, that there aren't places to play, you know, there aren't places where you can learn how to work the room, you know, or work, be in a situation where you can learn your craft, you know. Because if you're any good now, it's almost like you get sucked up too quick, you know, before you've learned how to do something that's going to last. It's very hard to wrap it up. I can't think how you wrap this up neatly, you know.
I think, Nick, how you wrap it up is you bring another record out and show everybody how it's done.
Now, don't start all that. Flannel.
I'd be the first queuing outside HMV for your next album, that's for sure.
That's very decent of you to say that, Chris. Well, I'm still writing songs, but not very many now.
Mm.
I've done some pretty good stuff in recent years, you know, but not much of it. Also, I'm much more interested in having other people do my stuff than I am in doing it myself.
It pays dividends, I hear.
It can do.
It's never happened to me, but it sounds like it works for some.
Chris, please, you're not trying to say that you just operate in a vacuum, are you? Or no one's ever noticed you?
No, I mean, it is difficult to get songs covered much more these days than in the past, but, I mean, the kind of songs that squeeze right are not very coverable songs particularly.
God, really?
Yeah.
Some Fantastic Place is not coverable. My God, what a gorgeous song.
Yeah, thank you. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, having a song like in Bodyguard like you had, I mean, that's just a dream come true. Those things don't happen every year, you know.
Yes, well, certainly not that, no. That song, that just goes on and on, that one, yeah.
Mm.
But, well, I have sort of applied myself, you know, with that in mind. When I've made my own records, well, I kind of like them undercooked, you know, bare bonesy stuff anyway. But I have in the past tried to do my records that are really sort of showcases for the songs, hoping that someone's going to say, this pretty good song, this. Why, I'm sure I could do this one better than him, you know. And then, you know, as they say, the line goes taut, you know, the rod bends and you're reeling one in. Sometimes that happens. But
well, Nick, I want to thank you so much for donating your time this afternoon to talk on this podcast. It's been absolutely a treat for me. I wish it was in person.
Well, me too, Chris. Thank you very much. And I'm really sorry that I can't sort of... I feel really bad at the last hurdle I fell down. You asked me, can you offer any words of hope to any aspiring songwriter? And I go,
I think that what you're saying is there really isn't words of wisdom. You have to find that yourself.
Well, you do, yeah. Yeah, you do. Just listen to lots of people who are good at doing it as you can and make your own... It's all been done. It has all been done. It's just the bits and pieces that you take for your own recipe. You know, take a piece here, a piece here, a piece there. And don't be ashamed of it.
No.
Because when you put it in your own pot, it comes out as something new.
Yes, because we are magpies.
We are, indeed. But it's been so great to talk to you, Chris, and I look forward very much to seeing you in person also.
And please thank Roy for putting the recording together. That's very kind of him.
I shall.
All right. God bless you.
You too.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. What a great guy Nick is. He's done so much in his life. It's mind-boggling. And he's only just scratched the surface. Our paths, they cross quite often. And I suppose we've got lots of things in common. Though Curtis Digers has never covered one of my songs for a Whitney Houston film, Boo Hiss. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.